Hi, everybody. This is Carrie Diamond, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. Visit cordonbleu.edu to learn about the wide array of programs available, from the nine-month Grand Diplôme course of intensive studies to three-hour classes on topics such as wine, cheese, tarts, and macaroons. And La Brea Bakery, which was founded in 1989 in Los Angeles with a commitment to time-honored bread-making traditions. Visit labreabakery.com to learn more about La Brea's sustainable sourcing, patient artisan baking process, and where nationwide you can find their products. La Brea Bakery. Every detail, deliciously done. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, the show about women and food. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. For the first half of our show, I'm turning the reins over to Hester Cant, our British Bomb Squad correspondent. Hester sat down with Maxine Thompson, the founder of Polka Pants, one of my favorite fashionable foodies. Enjoy their interview.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm in a studio in East London with the wonderful Maxine Thompson. Maxine, thank you very much for being on Radio Cherry Bomb.
My pleasure.
Can you just, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about who you are?
My name's Maxine. I'm a chef. I'm Australian, and I founded a company called Polka Pants. We make trousers for females who work in hospitality.
Where did you grow up, and what part did food play in your growing up?
I actually grew up in a little town called Wumbai, which is, if anyone's ever been to the Sunshine Coast, there's a great big thing called the Big Pineapple, which goes with a lot of other big things in Australia. But I live right beside there. And the property that I grew up on is actually an old avocado farm. So I guess that's, you know, one of the first things that food played in my life is that I grew up on an avocado farm, and the property next to us was a mango farm. So we got to grow up eating lots of beautiful tropical fruit. But my parents always cooked, and we always cooked as kids, and we would sit down and have dinner together every night. And on the weekends, we'd just like go to the markets and spend the whole weekend cooking and eating and drinking. And it's always been a huge part of our family, and still is, even, yeah, everywhere, all over the world.
And that's, yeah, what an amazing thing that it was never a chore, and it was never it was just something that was part of it.
Yeah, it's always something that we do together. It's like every day is an excuse to just like cook something delicious and just eat and hang out with each other.
And you have quite a big family. Do you want to describe?
There's five of us. Well, six now, because I've got a twin sister and she's married. So we've got three girls and then my mum and dad. And my dad's loved it because he's always been surrounded by beautiful women his whole life. There's five of us and we all live in different countries. So my sister lives in LA now. I live in London and my older sister lives in Tokyo.
You're properly spread out.
Yeah, properly spread out.
And you've all kind of been involved in food. And do you want to just describe what happened when you grew up then, and you initially studied something different?
So I grew up and my sister and I kind of moved to Bristol when we were 18, and I just talked my way into kitchens over here because I think the guys in kitchens like the idea of having an 18-year-old girl as a sous chef, not the fact that I could cook, although I could sort of cook. And then I moved back to Australia and studied fashion design. But while I was studying, my sisters were also studying, and we all lived together and would cook together every single night. And we always had friends that would ask us for recipes. And so we started a food blog. This was about 12 years ago. We started a food blog, and then from that we got a cookbook deal. So that was kind of when cooking got serious, I guess, for me.
Yeah. And when was this in history? Because getting a cookbook deal from a blog is...
I meant to bring one in for you today. I forgot. I left it at home. So I think we got the deal about 10 years ago. So the book came out about 8 years ago. So it's a while now. So looking back on it, it's quite funny because it seems, you know, everybody has a cookbook these days. And it's quite a funny thing. You look at it now and it's so dated. There's so many things that we'd do differently, but it's still a nice thing to look at.
And tell us about the book. What's it like to work with both of your sisters on something?
Yeah, so the book doesn't have any food photography in it. It's all artwork. So we commissioned 70 artists from around the world. So we would send them around recipe and they would draw or paint their artistic interpretation of what the meal meant to them. working with my sisters was really fun and really hard. I think I kind of got the easy way out of it in some sense. I was living in New York when we got the book deal, and so I kind of skipped on all the testing and stuff and just got like the final input. I did have to do some testing in my tiny, tiny New York apartment, which is a bit of a logistical challenge. But then I helped my older sister. Like I wrote all the recipes and then she would copy edit them and then test them as well. So it was, and then my twin sister does design. So it was kind of the perfect match for all of us.
You all played a part. And yeah. What's the cuisine of the book?
God, I mean, we're Australian, so it's sort of from all walks of life. You know, our parents grew up all around the world. My dad grew up all around the world, and my mum's, you know, from rural Australia. So I guess, yeah, and then we've thankfully have travelled a lot, and so it's, you know, bits and pieces from everywhere. And Australian cuisine, you know, it's influenced from everyone around the world. So a lot of Asian, a lot of Indian.
And are there any particular recipes that you remember or still cook now? Or?
I think one that's a hugely sentimental thing in the book, it's called Corned Beef and Friends, which is just like beef that you boil, which sounds really horrible. And this thing called Beetroot Vladimir, which is still one of my favorite things ever in the world to eat. It's beetroot that you grate, grate down and then cook in a pan with a bit of butter and flour, so like make a roux, and then with lemon juice and thicken it, and so it goes kind of like like a gluggy red beetroot paste, but it's so delicious. Yeah, it's great with smoked fish as well.
Sounds amazing. Mm. So you did this book. What happened off the back of that? You were working in New York. You weren't being a chef there, were you?
No, I wasn't a chef. I kind of moved to New York after studying fashion design and chased my dreams of being a textile designer. But I landed a job at Chanel, but not doing anything creative. I was working in their sort of business strategy team, making sure that, you know, all the sales targets and all the stores were being met, and that, and that all the VIP clients were taken care of. So I got to drink a lot of champagne with Missy Elliott and Lindsay Lohan, which was kind of the highlight of my career, I think. But yeah, I wasn't doing anything creative, and I was still working as a private chef on the side. And then we got the cookbook deal, so I think that was just sort of a catalyst for me quitting my job there. And then I quit my job at Chanel and trained at the French Culinary Institute, which was awesome.
Wow. And that was just a sequence of events that was quite natural, or was there some, apart from the book, was there something in particular that was like, right, I'm doing this?
No, it was quite natural. Like I kind of, you know, when I moved to Bristol and was 18 and worked in kitchens, I was kind of always toying with the idea. I think thankfully now the food industry has changed, and, you know, being a chef or working hospitality is kind of seen as a career decision now, and not just something you do because you couldn't get a real job. So I think, you know, 10 years ago, myself and my parents maybe were still in that mentality where you had to go and get a degree and a real job. Mm. And so I sort of did that for a while. Like I did a business degree with my fashion degree because it was the only way my dad will let me go to art school. And I mean, I'm very thankful now because it's helped me a lot in running my business.
Tell us a bit about what it was like going to the French Culinary Institute.
It was so much fun. I made one of my best friends there, a girl called Leela. I think on the first day we both got kicked out of class for wearing bright red lipstick. and so we're like, excellent, we're both going to be friends. But it was really fun. I mean, I could always cook, but it was really good to go back and learn how to do things properly and why to do them, and how to keep your station tidy, and just go back to school again. Yeah, I loved it.
And what was the biggest difference between the kind of commercial and business world you'd been in to suddenly being in a kitchen? Was it a shock? Was it a pleasant surprise?
It was a really pleasant surprise. It was just nice not to have to take yourself so seriously. Like, I mean, because cooking is something that I love and comes so naturally, it's just like, you know, you jump out of bed and skip to school every day. It was like, you know, you can cook with your eyes closed. So it felt, yeah, like a really natural thing to do.
That's wonderful. And you didn't do the full 3 years. Do you want to describe your course?
I just did an express course. So I think it was 6 months. So we did nine till three every day. And then I did an externship while I was at school. Mm-hmm. So you go and cook in a restaurant like 3 or 4 nights a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that did that cement you after you finished that? Were you like, right, this is it. I'm going to start a restaurant. I'm going to go into private chef. Like when you finished that, where were you at in your head?
Definitely down the chef road. Yeah. I loved it. I loved working in restaurants. I loved the camaraderie, the energy, the passion, the food, the late nights. I loved it. And so I left New York mainly for visa reasons, because no one wants to sponsor a chef. So I hadn't been back to Australia in about 3 years. So I left and moved back to Australia and moved to a tiny town called Hobart in Tasmania, because I was like 27 and went from living in New York to Hobart. I was like, maybe I hate myself. Yeah, like an eighth of the population or something. And then I got a really beautiful job in a really beautiful restaurant down there that did a 10-course tasting menu that changed every single day, and we only used produce that was from Tasmania. So half the time we wouldn't know what we were getting from the suppliers until we walked into the restaurant in the morning. And so that, and it was like a zero waste restaurant. And so that completely changed my whole idea of cooking, and everything that I learned just kind of like threw everything to the wayside and had to retrain myself in that sort of sense. But I loved it. It was, you know, the best like 9 months. But it was actually in that restaurant where I thought of polka pants.
That was going to be my question. So why was that?
Well, the kitchen that we were working in was kind of half open, half not open. And it was sort of, you know, how long ago was this? Like 5 years ago. So it was kind of at the trend where dining was becoming more of an immersive experience, and chefs were playing more of a role in, you know, that dining experience. And you would have to run plates of food out to tables and sort of explain what it was. And obviously, having worked in fashion, I do sort of care what I look like in the kitchen. I don't mind getting covered in food, but you kind of want to, you know, look a bit nice if you're running food out to tables. And I just couldn't find any trousers that were comfortable. I bought some horrible chef ones, and they were so baggy and would get caught on corners as I was running around, and I'd trip over them. And then I started cooking in high-waisted jeans, and I would pass out because they were too hot. And then I bought some trousers off, like, you know, from ASOS or, you know, websites, and would be scrubbing down the stove every night, and then all the dye from the black would bleed all over my chef whites. So I just had, you know, horrible stained whites. And then because I could sew, I was like, something, this isn't working. And so I started making my own trousers and just wearing them into the kitchen. And it felt so much better. And, you know, I could work in them. I could bend over in them. I could go out and see people. I could go to the pub straight after work and wouldn't have to get changed. And so I was like, oh, I wonder if this is, if anyone else has this problem or if it's just me. So I kind of like filed it into the back of my head. And then at that point, I was done with living in Hobart. I'd run out of people to date. I'd run out of things to do. It's a very small town. And so I left and moved to England. And then it was here I kind of did a lot of market research. Like, I sent questionnaires out to all the culinary schools, to all my old culinary schools, like in America, back to Australia, and just started to file like information on, you know, what women would consider their dream trousers in kitchens. And then started making some prototypes and sent a few pairs out to some female chefs in London to wear and get their feedback. And then sort of made some changes from that to develop what polka pants are today.
In that kitchen in Hobart, when you knew what you didn't want anymore, can you just explain for those of us who haven't worked in kitchens what a good chef's trouser needs to be? Like, you know, people, what's the difference between that and wearing a pair of jeans?
Jeans are hot, you know, they don't breathe. I guess like most comfortable trousers to work in are breathable, so that's why we use 97% cotton, and because they're really easy to wash as well, so you can just throw them in and they're quite durable, and they stain, you can get stains out of them really easily as well, and they've got a little bit of stretch, so you can bend and move and squat and jump up on tables and crawl under tables quite easily. And they're high-waisted, so because I think when I was working as a chef in Hobart, I think I had some like lower waist trousers on, and I bent over and my head chef put a spoon down my trousers, and that was kind of it. He used to put a spoon or like a 10p coin or something if he could see like your bum hanging out. And so, you know, that's one of those things. And I think also with the trend in kitchens of women or people just tucking t-shirts in and not having to wear chef coats anymore, I think that's a nice thing, because then you can still tuck a t-shirt in and it protects you from getting splattered by hot things.
Mm, so they've got to protect you as much as they want to be comfortable.
Yeah.
And also yours are beautiful as well. So
thank you.
When you sent them out to people, what was the initial feedback, the initial round of them in London?
Everyone was really excited. Yeah, really excited, you know, because it is quite a niche product. But I think a few people who got them were just like, oh my God, why didn't I think of this? Like, it seems like such a simple thing. But, you know, in my market research, I did, yeah, looked into it a lot, and there was nobody else in the world doing them specifically for women.
Mm. And that's a really important thing, not just because of you doing it, because you know how to do it and you know what is needed, but why do you think it's important to have it designed by a woman for women? Does it give you something in the kitchen that you otherwise wouldn't have?
Yeah, because you understand women's bodies as well. Like, I think we've designed them so they kind of fit all shapes and sizes. Like, our sizes now go from 0 to 22, and it's exactly the same pattern but just scaled up or down. You know, they fit women with no hips, women with big hips, women with small bums, women with big bums, you know. I mean, that's the beauty of being a woman, is that we do come in all shapes and sizes. And I think, you know, it you have to be a woman to kind of understand those design principles fully.
And I know we've talked about this, but I'm sure there are women in kitchens now across, well, the world, but, you know, who are wearing these awesome trousers, and men are starting to be like, oh, wait a second, can I get some of those? You get quite a lot of requests.
I do. I've started a folder in my inbox of, like, men who want trousers. But I think, I don't know, I think because of what Polka Pants is kind of, not stands for, but sort of represents, is this big, like, community of women, and all the good things they're doing, I think it would be quite a kick in the face if we then started to do a men's range. So I think if we were going to do it, we would maybe do, you know, some secret underground boys club. But no, I think we'll just do girls' trousers. But we do have some men that have started to wear them, which I'm not sure how flattering they are. But
well, I mean, if they're that desperate,
yeah,
it's a sign that they want to.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the patterns and the designs that you do? Because you've got a really great range. I mean, all of them go with everything.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
What
was the first one, for example?
The first one was black and houndstooth, because houndstooth is, you know, classic in kitchens. And actually the first one is our signature polka dot pair, because, and that's kind of a little homage back to my fashion world life, because for my, like, I guess it would be similar to like a dissertation project over here, because we don't really have them in Australia. My final business project is, we opened up a shop with like the 8 other girls that I was doing the fashion business degree with. And the night that the shop launched, I made myself these high-waisted polka dot trousers, similar to the black and white ones that we have. And then I took them with me to New York, and I would always wear them whenever I was cooking my private chef jobs or anything like that, and then took them to Tasmania with me and literally wore them till they fell apart. And so that was kind of the reason why we've got the black and white polka dot ones, because it kind of encompasses my journey, I guess, to how I got to polka pants today.
And is that where the name comes from?
Yeah, that's where the name comes from. And then, so we've got black and houndstooth, and then we've got white, which are really lovely and kind of based more towards the US market, because a lot of girls over there are cooking all white. And then we've just launched our first ever chef collaboration with celebrity chef and TV personality Gizzy Erskine, and we worked together to develop a leopard print, which is amazing, because leopard print is both of Gizzy my favorite color. And so, yeah, Gizzy's been a huge support ever since, like, before we launched. I sent her a pair, and she was kind of the person that was like, god, why didn't I do this? And ever since then, so about 2 years ago, she always wanted to, she's like, let's, how do we collaborate? And so it's sort of been a long time in the making, so it's nice to kind of finally see them come to fruition.
And in the future, what kind of things are you looking to do collaboration-wise?
I think we've got in the pipeline to do a collaboration with an Australian label called Worktones, which they do some more like menswear and unisex, but we're going to do a little female capsule collection with them. We're going to do sort of more of a shirt dress, an actual pair of jeans, and an apron.
Wow, oh. So
yeah, I know, and things further down the line, we want to do, you know, shoes. We'd like to do an apron collaboration.
I was going to say, what's next? Poker shoes.
Poker shoes, yeah.
Poker underwear, is that a thing? I mean, what's the underwear experience like as a female chef?
A lot of girls wear sports bras. I mean, because, you know, you don't want to wear, like, your nice, lacy underwear when you're cooking in hot kitchens, when you just sweat through it. So a lot of girls cook in, like, yeah, sports bras. Yeah.
So there you go.
Poker bras, yeah.
So going back a bit to the business, so once you sent out your trousers to people and you got good feedback and then you'd made some changes, Talk me through that moment until when people started getting them in the post, when it was book advanced.
So when was that? God, we started sending samples out, I think, in October. I was working a horrible corporate chef job at this point because it paid really well and it allowed me to save to do Polka Pants. But I got to a point, I was like, if I have to make another scrambled egg white omelette, I'm going to kill myself. But it was fun. And like the women who I worked with were very thankful. So I could do a lot of research while I was there. But so that was October, and then I hired an amazing PR person called Gemma Bell in London, who used to work in fashion PR, and she started doing food, oh God, maybe like 5 years ago, but she's awesome, and I knew that she would be such a good person to like help me launch the brand. So we just kind of started sending samples out to people, getting some press secured, and then we threw a massive party in February 2015, I think, at a wine bar called Sager and Wild. So there was about 70 food obsessed women, and it was really fun. We just set up a table of like a changing room of trousers and a mirror, and it was everyone just kind of went up and tried them on and, you know, took selfies. I think, what's the thing that they call it now, a belfie, like a bum selfie?
That's new to me, but that sounds great.
And I was like, wow, that's interesting. Because, you know, it's somehow, I didn't design them to be complete, like, make a big focus on female bums, but I think that's kind of one thing that has sort of happened from it all.
Everyone's bum looks amazing.
Exactly. And so, yeah, lots of people trying them on and like creating a bit of hype on Instagram and stuff. And then it's just had a really nice natural progression. Like, we don't really do any sort of advertising, or we don't have any stockists or anything. So it's just kind of grown naturally through word of mouth and through social media.
And that's the best way, because it means you've got real recommendations from people. You're not, yeah. You know, it's not just an image thing. It's, you can see that through things like Instagram, you're kind of advertising yourself, but you're doing it through women who are actually wearing them in their own kitchen doing their job. It's not, you know, you haven't just found the person who looks the best in them.
Exactly. I had a really nice, I actually made me cry, an email from a woman the other day who said she bought the trousers in like, you know, five different sizes, and then she just sent me an email, and I was like, you're right, do you need some help with sizing? And she sent me an email saying that she had just got out of 6 months in hospital battling an eating disorder, and she said that although she's still coming to terms like with being a size 12, she's just come from being a size 00. But she said all the like the pictures that we put up of women looking really healthy in our trousers has been such a huge inspiration for her, and so has helped her along the way. Which, like, I got it and like absolutely wept. I was like, you know, I think that can, you know, in such a time when women are so like body conscious and stuff, getting something like that is really special. And I was having a really bad day, and so getting an email like that makes you be like, okay, maybe I'm doing an okay thing.
You really are. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, and just seeing people that you can completely identify with. And also, because a lot of people who listen to this are, you know, looking to maybe go into this kind of thing, food businesses, their own, they're looking to go out on their own. And so seeing, you know, you doing something that supports women doing the same thing is also beautiful.
Yeah, and I think there's such a good, like, a strong support network out there as well, like, for people that started their own business and all in the same sort of boat. Like, I met Ellen Bennett from Headley and Bennett, and she's awesome, and I email her a lot, and she's always so helpful, and she's so busy but always kind of gives me a time of day and will always respond to emails, which is wonderful, and I admire her so much about what she's done, and I kind of can only hope that Polka Pants gets to, you know, where her business is one day.
Well, and you met her at the Jubilee.
Yeah, I did meet her at the Jubilee.
Tell us, I wasn't there.
It was so fun. I was so nervous meeting her. But yeah, because I was part of Polka Pants, was very kindly invited to be part of the first market day. And it was awesome. And I loved it meeting, you know, because you get to know everybody by their Twitter handles or their Instagram handles. And so you have such a special relationship with these people that you've never met. So it was, for me, it was an amazing experience to go and meet them face to face.
And that's kind of part of the journey that's, you know, bring people from you designing it to getting it out to people. And, and do you want to give us a bit of advice about, you know, maybe not this exact business model, but people out there often are looking to do similar things, and they, and what, have you ever been given really good advice, or you went to business school, but have you
also, 10 years ago.
Also, what's maybe some advice about people trying to do something on their own where they're really, you know, they really have really good conviction about their ideas?
It's really hard. but I guess just talk to people as much as you can. I think Agatha, one half of Ovenly in New York, who are amazing, I met them like ages ago when they were just starting, and she just said, you know, talk to as many people as you can. She's like, you only know what you only know, and that's it. And someone else is going to know more than you about some other things, so you can only do as much as you can and then ask. And people are always so willing to help as well. Yeah. And sometimes it takes more, like, you know, confidence and, I guess, like, for lack of a better term, balls to just ask for help. Like, so many times you sit here and feel like I beat my head against a wall rather than just asking for help. And when you do, you're like, oh, wow, that solved that problem.
And these trousers are available. Are they available worldwide?
Yeah, worldwide. We ship it everywhere in the world. We don't have any stockists yet, but we ship everywhere in the world.
So anyone listening right now could order some.
Yeah, you can buy them.
And also, not only are they available around the world, but you can potentially have your own pair made just for you.
Yes, that's one thing we're like really trying to push, is the customization. So we've made a couple of pairs. We've got this amazing sommelier called Kate, who runs a pop-up restaurant with her boyfriend called Food Wine Pop-Up. And she's got an amazing, like, she's a sommelier, so she's got, you know, a line drawing of like wine bottles and corks, which are really cool. And then my friend Henrietta, who's an amazing baker, she's got some hot pink ones. Because it's the same pattern, it's so easy for us to roll out different colours. So, you know, if you have a bakery or your logo that you want to get on there, we can definitely do that.
And people would just send you the material, or do they send...
No, just a colour, like a colour that they want us to match, or their logo that they want to get printed, and we sort of go from there.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's fun. I love doing it because it makes me feel like I'm actually, you know, a designer and a creative rather than sending customer service emails. And we're actually just working. I just made my first pair of maternity polka pants for my friend, who's an amazing chef called Elizabeth Allen, who's one of our brand ambassadors. But she is very heavily pregnant and still working. And so this is something that we're definitely trying to develop for next year. So she's being the guinea pig and testing them out. But yeah, because we've had so many female chefs, chefs who have bought the trousers and were like, yeah, love your trousers, can't wear them anymore because I'm pregnant and I'm still working, so I'm back to my elasticated ones. So yeah, I guess, you know, it's a natural progression for girls who do fall pregnant and keep wanting working. We want them to still be able to wear polka pants. That's still look stylish and comfortable.
And that's the coolest thing. I feel like that's the most empowering thing you could do. And also because they look so great as well.
They do. And Elizabeth was like, wow, it's nice to see my bum again. Because they're exactly the same. They've just got like an elasticated bit at the front.
That's amazing. Oh, Maxine, thank you so much. We want to also know where everybody can find you. So give us all your details.
Yeah, they can. The online store is polkapants.com, and then Instagram, where polkapants with an underscore at the end, and same with Twitter and Facebook.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on Radio Terrible.
My pleasure.
Le Cordon Bleu. The renowned culinary school was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine. And from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world, or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
La Brea Bakery was founded in 1989 with a commitment to time-honored artisan traditions. This means a patient 24-hour process with master bakers who guide the proper rise, scoring, and baking for exceptional flavor. Each loaf is made using the original 1989 starter, creating an airy, open crumb and a golden crust. For a delicious taste that's worthy of your most special moments, how about La Brea's take-and-bake classic French baguettes, or its gluten-free multi-grain sliced sandwich bread, or its rosemary olive oil round? To find a store near you that carries La Brea's breads, visit labreabakery.com. La Brea Bakery. Every detail, deliciously done. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. Our next guest is Amanda Fredrickson. Amanda is a popular blogger based in Los Angeles. She's a career changer who got her start at the Williams-Sonoma Test Kitchen in San Francisco. We're working with Amanda as part of a project with La Brea Bakery. She and I chatted by phone last week about blogging, bread, and a lot more. Enjoy. So I'd like to welcome Amanda Fredrickson to Radio Cherry Bomb. Hi, Amanda.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
How are you?
Sorry, timing. I just kicked him out too.
That's good timing. I guess there's a dog who lives with you.
Yes.
What's your dog's name?
His name is Chumley. And he is kind of like my best friend, but he likes to bark at all the people that walk by my house.
what kind of dog is Chumley?
He is a lab and a mastiff mix. We got him at a pound a couple years ago, so we're not quite sure, but he's just kind of a mutt.
It's a good message for the holidays. Adopt, don't shop, people.
I totally agree.
I adopted my cat, and she is the light of my life. And I know a lot of people with shelter dogs who just adore their pups.
Yeah. It was the best $25 I've ever spent in my whole life. So,
we could probably talk about dogs all day, but we are going to talk about food because that is Amanda's thing. She has a wonderful website, AmandaFredrickson.com, and lots of videos. If you are someone who loves to watch cooking videos, Amanda's really terrific, and it's almost like a mini cooking school getting to watch
you
do all those videos. But honestly, the first thing I noticed watching your videos, your manicure is always perfect. How, with all the chopping and cutting, and I'm guessing you do your own dishes unless you have an army of minions there that
I wish
we don't know about. How do you keep your manicure so nice?
So I live in LA. We moved to LA probably about a year and a half ago, and coming from the Bay Area where you could walk everywhere, LA was kind of like a different vibe for me in that sense. And so the one place that I can walk to is a nail salon, and I've made friends with the owner, and I bring her kind of like all of my leftover baked goods and kind of food that I can't eat, my husband and I can't eat myself. So in return, we kind of do a little trade. So she does my nails, and then I give her all the free food from my kitchen.
That's pretty funny. And do you wear gloves when you wash the dishes?
I don't. I really don't. Huh. I've seen kind of old coworkers wear gloves. I just kind of want to get in there and get it over with, so I don't wear gloves.
Yeah, I find that's my manicure killer. I pretty much don't get my nails done anymore, except for special occasions. But I find that a lot of times when my knife skills aren't the best, I will actually cut into my nails, and I guess that's why your nail is there to protect your fingers. But sometimes, you know, I'll just like nick my nail, and I'm like, oh, okay, the human body is so fascinating. I guess that's why my nails are there. So
that's true. That's good. It's kind of like a self-protector for your hands.
Exactly. But you have very good knife skills. Did you go to culinary school?
I did. I went to San Francisco Cooking School about 5 years ago. I'm a complete career changer. I was doing something in the nonprofit sector, both fundraising and event planning. And always loved to cook, and that was kind of like my calling. And so one day, I got up the courage, I quit my job, and I went to cooking school.
Is that Jody Liano's school?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
She's fantastic. Oh, yeah, we're really big fans of hers. That's so cool. So what did you study there?
So I did the kind of full kind of culinary program, the 6 months full-time culinary program. So you learn everything from knife skills, how to break down a pig, to how to, you know, bake a cake, kind of all of everything encompassing in kind of 4 months of hands-on training in a kitchen classroom, and then a two month out, kind of out in the restaurant real world stage.
Oh, very cool. So I should mention that what brought us together is La Brea Bakery. We're doing a really fun influencer program with La Brea Bakery, where folks like you are making some recipes specifically for us using La Brea. And we're going to talk about those recipes in a little while, but thanks to them for bringing us together. So what made you decide to focus on video?
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, my husband and I moved down from the Bay Area to LA about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years. And I was previously working in the Williams-Sonoma Test Kitchen, where I was kind of cooking all day, hands-on cooking, and always kind of interested in that kind of internet, social media world, and especially the visual aspect of it. So when we moved down to LA, I had some spare time, and I was looking at kind of what was trending both on the internet and social media, and it was video. Video was just kind of very, you know, it was just starting to trickle in. Now it's everywhere, but it was just kind of starting to be more mainstream, especially in the food world. So I basically bought a camera and watched a whole bunch of YouTube videos and taught myself how to film these little hands in the pan videos.
And who edits for you?
I do.
Wow. That's free. Impressive. That's impressive. So, so you're totally self-taught in that respect.
100% self-taught. I think it's amazing what you can learn on the internet. I just watched so many YouTubes. A lot of it was trial and error. There's a lot of videos that never made it to being posted because they just messed up. But it's amazing what you can learn on YouTube and then just trying it and seeing what happens.
Oh, I'm so impressed. So let's go back to Williams-Sonoma because I have been to that test kitchen, and that is a really nice test kitchen with the best view in San Francisco.
It is. It is totally amazing. The view is incredible. And just all the tools and the products that you get to use, it was amazing. I was there for about 2.5 years, and it was one of the best learning experiences anyone could hope for. It was incredible.
Now, that's a dream job to work in a test kitchen. How did you get that gig?
It is a complete dream job. So after cooking school, I did my stage at a restaurant in San Francisco, and it was at SPQR, kind of up in kind of central San Francisco. And Amanda Haas, who runs the test kitchen, had written their cookbook. And kind of around that time, she and I connected through Jody, through San Francisco Cooking School, and they were looking for someone to cover maternity leave for one of the cooks that was leaving from the test kitchen. And so I basically like jumped at the chance, and I was kind of given the opportunity for 6 months, and then I just kind of like kept on showing up. And eventually it turned into a full-time job.
So cool. Did you get to know Jean Armstrong while you were there?
I did. She's amazing. I just saw her recently here in LA. She is amazing.
Jean is like the godmother of Cherry Bomb. She's always kind of looking out for us. And I just love her British accent and love her energy and all that.
She's wonderful. I actually saw her at the Cherry Bomb Jubilee in San Francisco. We caught up.
Oh, good. Yeah. They were, they very kindly were one of the sponsors of the conference. So you clearly like warm weather. You, even though you were born in New York, you grew up in Florida and then had stints lots of different places. But tell me about growing up in Florida. What was that like?
I think growing up in Florida is one of those things where you hate it when you're actually growing up there, but you love it once you leave it. It's one of those places that you look back and you're like, wow, I had it pretty great. You know, the fact I could go to the beach after school was pretty incredible. And so I think now my husband and I are kind of like figuring out where we want to be long term, and you're realizing that Florida was pretty great, kind of how I grew up. You know, I struggled with it being a small town, and I wanted diversity and I wanted changes of seasons. And I've gotten that in places that I've lived, but it's one of those stories where you kind of can't wait to leave, but then you get a little older, you're like, maybe I should go back.
What was your family like?
So my mom passed away when I was really little. My dad remarried. We kind of had, you know, a rocky, normal family. And no one really cooked in my family. And I think that's why I probably have become a cook. Because I missed that. Like, I wanted someone to teach me how to cook.
Yeah. How old were you when your mom passed away?
I was 4. Ooh. I was really little.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That's awful.
Thanks. Yeah. It's, you know, it shapes you kind of how you grew up as well, too.
Did you have...
You know, we're a closer family because of it, too, I think.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have 2 sisters and a brother. There's a lot of us.
Were you the youngest?
I'm right in the middle. So older sister, younger brother, and younger sister.
Wow. And... So you said nobody cooked in the family. So what was mealtime like? Who took care of everybody?
Mealtime was not good. It wasn't very tasty. My dad would, you know, make a steak, but there's only so many times you can have a steak. And as a 12-year-old, the last thing at least I wanted was a steak for dinner. And I love to bake. I still love to bake. And I loved to bake growing up. I've just always kind of been really drawn to using your hands and kind of getting dirty in there. And so I would just kind of like teach myself on the side or kind of try and get in there. I was always looking for someone to kind of pass down these family recipes, which I'm still waiting for, I think.
And who handled school lunches?
We did. Oh, my dad did. You know, a lot of times you just, you made a peanut butter sandwich or you grabbed a bag of cereal and went. And I mean, it was a wonderful childhood and I loved my childhood. It's just funny, looking back on it now.
I can imagine. So So how did you eventually learn how to cook? You said you went to culinary school, but obviously you had to take care of yourself for a while before you went to culinary school. So how did you slowly start to develop these skills on your own?
So I think a lot of women just like me, kind of that grew up in the 2000s, you know, 2010 areas, they watch TV. And I grew up watching Martha Stewart. I grew up watching Ina Garten. I lived in New York right after college, and that was kind of like my Saturday morning was drinking coffee and watching all of these amazing women teach people how to cook. And when I moved to San Francisco, that's kind of when the light bulb went off. You had these amazing, this amazing produce. You had these vendors, you know, that were so interested in their craft. And when I moved to San Francisco, I just kind of fell head over heels with cooking again. And I think I also put all the pieces together kind of over my life, you know, why I always loved to bake or why I always, you know, wanted to know what we were eating for dinner or that sort of thing. But it all kind of came together in San Francisco.
And I noticed there's sort of a common thread that runs through a lot of your recipes. Everything's very beautiful, but homey, you know, like
you're
this banana bread with chocolate chips or chocolate chunks in it. And I was just like, I was kind of like, oh my God, I need to make that this weekend.
I think it might actually be, I know like Florida isn't really considered the South, but I do think there's some Southern influence, especially how I grew up. And so I think that there is the streak of Southern food and influence that I kind of follow, maybe not even knowing in my food.
And hospitality, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So tell us about the dish you made for us with La Brea. You did this incredible spinach and artichoke dip with cheddar and Gruyere, my favorite, and and La Brea Bakery baguette. What was the inspiration for that?
So I was thinking about the holidays and kind of things that you could do ahead of time. No one wants to be in the kitchen like the day of, scrambling around, especially figuring out what to make as an appetizer. And I love spinach and artichoke dip. I think a lot of traditional recipes are a little heavy, and so I wanted to make it lighter and kind of maybe a little more flavorful with the Gruyere and cheddar. I put a little panko breadcrumb on the top just for like a little crunch, and then also, of course, served it with the La Brea bread baguette, which you can toast beforehand, and it's just really perfectly addictive to go with the spinach and artichoke dip.
Yum. I'm one of those people who have spinach, and maybe this is from my childhood, but when spinach and artichoke dip is on the menu somewhere, I kind of have to order it.
I think it's fabulous, especially if it's in like a bread bowl. It's one of the kind of like the original amazing appetizers out there.
Exactly. So what's the next recipe you're doing for us?
So I'm working on some crostini, some kind of like holiday past crostini, just using their regular white bread. I think people a lot of times think they need to get fancy or find something kind of crazy to serve as appetizers for the holiday. But I think you can just take an amazing piece of white bread, toast it, and then put on different vegetables and different spreads and make a really easy past holiday hors d'oeuvre.
I love a crostini. This just popped in my head and I have no idea what the answer is. But what's the difference between bruschetta and a crostini? I need to look that up.
I think bruschetta is when you have the tomatoes and kind of
Okay.
Yummy deliciousness on top of a crostini.
Okay. That sounds about right.
We're going to go with that, right?
I had floating in my head bruschetta, crostini, tartine, like just all these sort of yummy.
Galette, crostata, yeah, it's all the same.
Exactly. So what are you doing for the holidays?
So I'm going to go to Montana. My husband's family spends a lot of time in Big Sky right outside of Bozeman. And so we're going to go have like a white Christmas. I'm pretty excited to go out there. We spend a couple of days each year out there and it's amazing.
Oh, how nice. Wow. And do you cook for everybody?
Yes. In the past I have cooked. I try and cook kind of every year. So I think this year, Christmas Eve is always meatballs and spaghetti. That's kind of like our mainstay. And then I'm going to figure out something new, I think, to make for Christmas Day this year.
Oh, yum. Well, I think I might make the spinach and artichoke dip. That looks so
good.
And there are a lot of picky eaters in my family, and I think they'll all really like this. I won't tell them there's Gruyere in it. That might put them over the edge.
Okay.
But
the cheddar.
What they don't know. Well, no, I still might use Gruyere, but I just won't tell them that there's Gruyere in there.
Yeah,
I feel like what you don't know won't kill you, right? As long as
there
are no Gruyere allergies in my family, so I don't think we need to worry about that. But and also, what else is up next for you? What's up professionally?
Yeah, and I'm actually pretty excited about this kind of coming year. I just finished writing the Stove cookbook for them, which is amazing because I love Stove as a company and I'm connected with them, and they are coming out with cookbook next September. So I just finished writing all those recipes. I think they're shooting it as we speak, which is going to be really, really fun to see that come to life. And I'm also really excited to kind of start. And I've been thinking a lot about kind of the food that I make over the year. And I, like I said before, I have an older sister who has three kids, and I have a lot of friends that are kind of like too afraid to cook or too nervous to cook. So I think I'm going to shift more of my, although I love to bake, maybe kind of make more recipes, you know, like one pan dishes or sheet pan or something that's a little more approachable, but yet still elevated to people.
Fantastic. So, well, we look forward to seeing what you're doing, and it's been really fun getting to know you and working with you on this La Brea Bakery partnership. So thank you for taking part.
Of course. Thank you. This was a wonderful opportunity, and I had the best time at the Jubilee in San Francisco. I can't wait to check out next year's.
Oh, good. Well, that makes two of us. So thank you, and have a really happy holiday.
Thank you. You too. Happy holidays.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's it for today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Tatasciore, producer Ali Mish, and our research assistant, Priya Krishna. Thank you to La Brea Bakery. Visit labreabakery.com to find a store near you that carries their delicious breads. La Brea Bakery, every detail deliciously done. And thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb all season long. Live the Cherry Bomb dream and sign up for culinary classes at cordonbleu.edu. If you need some cool holiday gifts, be sure to check out cherrybomb.com. We've got Bomb Squad bundles, signed copies of the Cherry Bomb Cookbook, our limited edition... I don't think
just,
I pronounced
just
the word
Just pick it up
gifts.
From there, yeah.
If you need some cool holiday gifts, be sure to check out cherrybomb.com. We've got Bomb Squad bundles, signed copies of the Cherry Bomb Cookbook, our limited edition collab apron with Headley and Bennett, and a lot more. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'm Jennifer Reichart, and I'm owner and winemaker of Raft Wines in Sonoma County, California. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Allison Smith-Story, owner of Smith-Story Wines, also in Sonoma County. She's a Texas gal with the biggest of hearts and always supports her fellow ladies in the wine industry. Also, are wrangling her lovable doodle sandwich.